The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot of that nuance of the analysis comes out through Q&A by members asking the briefers, why are you emphasizing this? Why did you use that word? What about this evidence that we've seen in other briefings that isn't included in this written document? Why is it that that isn't here? That is where the real detailed work of oversight comes, through finding out what the analysts think, why they think it, and tossing out some questions to get at the implications and maybe even prod the intelligence community to look in new directions. Those are all things that are, if not lost, certainly minimized if the oral briefings do go away.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 2nd, 2020. John Ratcliffe last week informed Congress that elections security briefings in the run-up to the 2020 election weren't going to be done orally anymore. There was going to be written intelligence product. There weren't going to be questions and answers. And people in Congress are PO'd. We thought we would chew it over, both from the intelligence community side and from the congressional side. We got just the group to do it. We've got David Preece, former CIA briefer. You know, he used to do briefings like this. And we got Margaret Taylor, you know, who's a former congressional staffer who used to consume briefings like this. We got them both in the virtual jungle studio. And we chewed it all over. Is this a big change or is it all puff? Will it stick? And what tools does Congress have to push back against it? It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 2nd, Briefings Schmiefings. All right, David, get us started. What did John Ratcliffe do the other day, and why is it causing such a stir?
So John Ratcliffe, who is the relatively new Director of National Intelligence, sends this letter to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and it's unclear when it was received, both on the House side and on the Senate side. We're hearing different stories about when the letter was sent and received, but it was dated the 28th. And in this letter, Ratcliffe takes some time to explain all of the things the intelligence community has done to keep Congress fully and currently informed. The main emphasis of the letter, however, is on the defensive briefings and election security updates to the Congress, as he notes, including many not required by law. And he points out that in the last few months, there have been many briefings, more than a dozen briefings, many open to all members of Congress or their staffs. And he notes somewhat cryptically in this letter, many of these engagements and products have been successful and productive, others have been less so. After that, he said, in order to ensure clarity and consistency, the engagements with Congress will now be with written finished intelligence products. Now, that rules out the oral briefings that constitute a great number of the interactions between intelligence officials and Congress, especially in this series of election security briefings that have been going on under the auspices of the Office of the Director of National intelligence. Two things came from this. One, which was not helpful and accurate, were headlines saying DNI is not going to brief Congress anymore. That's not the case. The DNI is saying we will provide intelligence assessments about election security. We are just going to provide them in writing. The second thing that happened was people realizing that distinction between the written product and the oral briefings said, oh, that's not good, because there's so much that comes out of those oral briefings with an opportunity for Q&A and follow-up that the written product just doesn't allow.
And David, what is your sense of the significance of this? Because on the one hand, it has definitely been received as a significant rollback of the intelligence community's willingness to provide Congress with election security information and briefings. But on the other hand, by its terms, it does not do that. It merely shifts the mode of the briefing and the information communication from the oral briefing to the written briefing.
That's right. It's both more significant and less significant than it appears. Let's do the latter first. It is not the Director of National Intelligence telling the intelligence community not to fulfill obligations to keep Congress informed. In fact, the written products sometimes do a better job of that. There have been many times in recent history and over the decades of congressional oversight of intelligence when sensitive matters were not put into writing. They were, in fact, briefed orally because they were so sensitive and to prevent leaks. So the fact that these assessments will continue to go to Congress in writing means that there is not an attempt, at least it does not appear so, there is not an attempt from the DNI to say, we're just not doing this oversight thing on election security anymore. We're overturning the consensus that we've had on congressional role in intelligence oversight since the late 1970s. So it is not that significant. It's not overturning that. On the other hand, there is a key difference between the written product and the in-person sessions with a briefer. With the written product, you get the bottom line assessment from the intelligence community. You get the logic and argumentation behind it. You see some of the evidence that led them to a particular judgment. And that's all good. That is part of informing Congress. However, especially given some of the controversies in recent weeks about how the DNI is structuring its assessments. Are they trying to amplify the purported threat from China and minimize the purported threat from Russia? A lot of that nuance of the analysis comes out through Q&A by members asking the briefers, why are you emphasizing this? Why did you use that word? Why didn't you use this word? What about this evidence that we've seen in other briefings that isn't included in this written document? Why is it that that isn't here? That is where the real detailed work of oversight comes, through finding out what the analysts think, why they think it, and tossing out some questions to get at the implications and maybe even prod the intelligence community to look in new directions. Those are all things that are, if not lost, certainly minimized if the oral briefings do go away.
I am old enough to remember what you alluded to a moment ago, which is that, you know, there have been times when both the IC and members of Congress preferred to do briefings orally. And the reason from the IC's side, I suppose, was lack of, you know, less capacity for leaks, particularly leaks of documents. The reason from the congressional side was, you know, frankly, more plausible deniability. That is, right. If you were briefed on something orally, you could, in a kind of Jim Sensenbrenner kind of way, pretend you didn't see the briefing or you didn't know about it, and you're shocked anyway that this activity is going on. And on the other hand, it allows for, if you have a piece of paper, you're really accountable for knowing what was on the sheet of paper. So is this a situation where Congress is doing a kind of grass is greener thing? If they get the oral briefings, they want the written briefings. If they get the written briefings, they want the oral briefings, or are they really losing something here?
Good intelligence oversight should get both. And as much as there is tension from the intelligence community historically in terms of briefing Congress, it has become the norm that the intelligence community will provide written and oral briefings to Congress. I've spoken with all of the DNIs up until this one, and to a person, I think all of them would say that they don't enjoy briefing Congress. They don't enjoy the grilling and the tough questions and the possible politicization, and certainly in the open testimony, the feeling that there's always the possibility of something sensitive being revealed. I don't think they relish the experience. But I think to a person, all of them would say, but this is what we do, and this is a part of the job to do it both in terms of written responses to questions and oral briefings when requested. The oddity of this experience, Ben, is that Ratcliffe is putting out the logic for providing only written products and not oral briefings that there have been too many leaks. And the acting chairman of the Senate committee, Marco Rubio, followed this up with a statement calling the leaks recently vile and grotesque. Well, that may be true, but if so, the logic then would be come in and provide us the oral briefings and not the written briefings, because a written document, any member of Congress can take and read it directly to a reporter or photocopy it and give it to somebody. An oral briefing is not hard to leak, but it's a little bit harder to leak the details and the nuances than it is when you have the written document that you keep with you. So it is a little bit odd to see the logic of preventing leaks being applied in the opposite way that it has usually been applied.
All right, Margaret. So David's talked about this from a intelligence community perspective. Let's talk about it from a congressional perspective. Ratcliffe, of course, is reasonably sophisticated about both. He was only very recently a member of Congress. Why do you think he wants to limit the communication this way? Surely he knows that what David just said is correct, that if you create a paper trail, that doesn't reduce the capacity for leaks. It arguably increases it. And it, in any event, increases the accountability in the sense that if you whisper something in my ear in an oral briefing and I go spill it, you can claim you never said it, or you can say that I mischaracterized it. But if you give me a piece of paper with five sentences on it and I read those five sentences to the press, you can't tell me you never said them. And so what do you understand Ratcliffe to be trying to do here?
So I'm going to be much less even-handed maybe than David is. I think that Ratcliffe is trying to limit the amount of information and nuance that members of Congress get, specifically with respect to what Russia is doing probably right now to interfere in the 2016 election. I suspect that what Russia is doing is more sophisticated than what was done in 2016, and that it's very active, that they've learned from what their successes and their failures, that they're doing even more. And I think that Ratcliffe is trying to limit the amount of information that gets to Congress and to the public about those realities. And that's consistent with President Trump's goals, it would seem. So I'm not usually so in politic, but for me and for folks that I talk to on a regular basis, this decision has been characterized to me by people on the Hill as fucking crazy. People are pretty apoplectic about it. And it's being viewed by many as, again, this sort of very deliberate mechanism for not having members ask tough questions. And the reality is, when I was on the Hill, I did do a number of these classified briefings. You have to prep your boss really well for these, because unlike other types of briefers, the briefers from the intelligence community, they're very good, they're very knowledgeable. But typically, they will only answer the very specific question that a member or a staffer asks them. They are not people who embellish or give you lots of context or anything like that. So in that sense, the member or a staffer, you have to know, you have to have a very specific question to ask, and you have to know which questions to ask. If you don't have specific opportunity to ask questions, you don't know what you don't know. And so to me, this definitely reads as a full frontal attempt to limit what members can ask about and understand about what is going on with respect to interference in the 2020 election. And just to take a few minutes, you know, you asked in the beginning about what's the story here. For me, the story begins back on July 24th when William Evanina, who's the director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, issued a pretty kind of milquetoast assessment of foreign interference in the 2020 election. It made sort of vague references to China and Russia. Members of Congress were very unhappy with it and said, this is unhelpful. It doesn't give Americans any sense for, you know, what's really going on or how they can protect their vote in the 2020 election. As a result of that and another briefing that occurred, the director of National Counterintelligence Security Center issued another kind of update to it on August 7th, which essentially said, you know, we're updating this. We're going to be more specific about the efforts of Russia, China, and Iran. And in that particular document, members of Congress then criticized that document saying, you know, this assessment incorrectly puts Russia and China on the same sort of plane in terms of what they're doing to interfere in the 2020 election. And based on members' classified briefings up to that point, that was not their impression, at least the Democratic members that came out and said something about that. So for me, this story about what this Ratcliffe letter is specifically tied to this series of events that relate to briefings to members of Congress and their reactions to it. And I think this is, it's an extremely bad development. It's going to cause so much mistrust between the branches, and something has really been lost here. Something valuable has been lost, and it's bad. It's really bad.
Okay, so before I get David to respond to that, I just want you to flesh out what the difference is between the world in which this is the mode and the world of oral briefings. So imagine that it's, you know, it's briefing time now, and you're the IC and I'm the congressional staffer or member. How does it work now? And just walk me through how I am losing versus before.
So, look, I've never encountered this kind of situation where, you know, you're allowed to view some sort of intelligence product, but there's no possibility of talking to anyone about it or getting someone to come up and brief about it. So it's a little bit of a strange sort of world for me. But, you know, I imagine what happens now is you know, the IC will say, okay, well, we just notifying people we sent over something. You can go take a look if you'd like. Members or staff or whatever can go down, read a document. And it seems like what they're saying, at least with respect to this election security bucket, is, you know, that's it. There's not going to be any briefings. You can maybe write some questions back to the agency and hope that they respond. So it's just pretty limited. I think I don't want to undersell how much I think members do get from that live back and forth with members of the intelligence community. And one of the ways that these types of briefings are unique, actually, is because they are behind closed doors, members tend to ask lots of questions that are factual in nature. In other words, it's not a lot of the grandstanding that you'll see when the cameras are on. They're very substantive, and members want to understand factually what is happening. And so it's actually a really substantive, they tend to be very substantive when it's sort of a real, when it's a real thing, right? When the people who are coming to do the briefing want the members to understand what is going on, they want them to really have a full understanding of things. It's really productive. That is not what is going to happen now. And the reality is that it seems the administration will have sort of an advantage in guiding the narrative, the public narrative, about what is going on in terms of the election interference. And members will no longer have that sort of inside scoop. They'll only have what the Intelligence Committee has decided that they're going to get. And they won't have that opportunity to probe more deeply. And so they're not going to have as many tools to be able to stand up and say, you know what? What the Trump administration is saying in public isn't consistent with what we are hearing behind closed doors when we ask questions in our role as the oversight body.
All right, David. So you have given a relatively benign account of this. Margaret has given a much less benign account. After hearing her take on it, are you more alarmed than 5 minutes ago?
I think I am equally as alarmed as I was 5 minutes ago, because I was describing the situation and not really commenting on it too much. But I happen to agree with just about everything Margaret said and how she said it, because I laid out the logic that Ratcliffe put out there. This is to prevent leaks, but the logic really doesn't add up. Then you have to go analytically to, okay, so if the stated goal of this is illogical, what else could be behind it? And there are two main things that pop into my mind. There's one overarching thing, which we can talk more about, which is what about the wider membership of the legislative branch, and what about informing the public? But even just limiting it to the Intelligence Committee itself, there's two things that pop to mind. And neither of them is good. One is that Ratcliffe is afraid that in questioning before Congress to the Intel committees, that professional members of the intelligence community will tell the truth. And if they have some nuances in their analysis that do not minimize the Russian threat enough, for example, that they will actually do their job and fulfill their oath and tell the members of Congress what it is they believe and why they believe it. That is one possibility, and it appears strong because the written briefings can and may in fact go through the office of the director himself, and he can tell the committees what he wants to have said. The other option, which I think is also bad, is that this is a trial balloon for other ways of getting in the way of intelligence norms and traditions. Well, we all know that this president and his administration have had no hesitation to upend norms. And certainly when it comes to providing things to Congress in other instances, they've been perfectly willing to put their heels in the sand and not offer things up. When it comes to traditional intelligence briefings, a lot of times that has continued under the radar. Well, now here's a norm of providing briefings to Congress, even though it's a new area. This election interference briefing thing by Bill Evaneva is new. This is not something that has been going on for decades. But the very practice of briefing Congress in writing and in person is a norm. And if he's walking that back just a bit to say, well, for this particular purpose, on this particular topic, we're not going to do in-person briefings anymore. Well, if there's not a really strong pushback, unified from both parties in Congress, maybe it's, okay, maybe we'll start providing the written products less often too. Or maybe we'll stop doing in-person briefings on a range of sensitive topics. Or maybe I'll start shooting down other intelligence norms, like the 70-year practice of offering presidential candidates classified briefings during the election cycle. That is a disturbing possibility because it shows that the intelligence process, which under the surface has largely been continuing to work, could be a new target of norm erosion. And this is just a first step to see how far it goes. So I wouldn't say I'm more optimistic than Margaret. In fact, depending on which of those is the dominant reasoning, perhaps both are in effect, I think it actually could be very harmful for the long-term oversight of intelligence. And honestly, for the neutral and apolitical intelligence analysis that the community has been doing.
Margaret, what do you know about what the reaction has been from Congress? You said the reaction you've heard from Democrats has been that this is, I believe your words were, fucking crazy. That's not an institutional pushback. Are you anticipating congressional reaction in a more formal sense? And if so, what are the chances that, as David says, it will be broad-based versus the sort of increasingly partisan reaction that we've come to expect on all things? Will this be the Senate Intelligence Committee that issued the report the other day in this grandly bipartisan fashion, or will this be the Devin Nunes v. Adam Schiff cage match?
Unfortunately, I think it's going to look more like the latter. If you start with, for example, what Marco Rubio has said, I did read sort of how his response came out, and it essentially says that Congress must be fully informed by the intelligence community, but these leaks have been outrageous and, as David said, grotesque. As I sit here, I'm not exactly sure what he's referring to with that. But the fact that he is equivocating on this and not coming out strong and saying, no, this is unacceptable, and the ODNI must continue to brief Congress in person, tells me that, you know, he's not going to be offering a strong response on this. The only other sort of real question in my mind then is, what is Majority Leader Mitch McConnell going to do? And I don't have any sort of information on that, but I would suspect that he will not necessarily come out strongly on it. So I do not anticipate a strong institutional reaction on this, because I do think Republicans will not be inclined to offer such a reaction. That said, of course, Democrats will continue, I think, to use very strong language about this and continue to make noise. But it's not clear to me that it will come to much of anything. I was reading that, you know, there is the possibility of, you know, subpoenaing Ratcliffe or other officials. But, you know, as we've seen over the past couple of years, that has not been a particularly fruitful path necessarily in it. And it is one that the Trump administration has resisted. So I'm not optimistic about how this ends. I think the only question is the one David posed, which is, will this new norm, which purportedly is just in the context of this election security issue, now bleed out to other areas where the Trump administration doesn't want Congress to ask a bunch of questions that might not be good for the Trump administration?
So it seems to me that there's another possibility of pushback here, and I want to game it out a little bit, because if I'm a member of Congress who has been given, from my point of view, an inadequate classified briefing, and I haven't had the chance to ask my questions, there is this tool that I have available, which is, number one, to write a public letter asking my questions. And that can always be done in an unclassified fashion, but of potentially a very revealing fashion, right? So, you know, dear Mr. Ratcliffe, in the briefing we received on such and such a date by letter, dated such and such, you alluded to things I can't refer to in an unclassified setting. However, I have certain follow-up questions. One, blah, blah, blah. Two, blah, blah, blah. Now, an artfully written such letter can, without revealing any classified information, be very painful to an organization that wants to keep secrets. And so my question is, shouldn't we expect, in light of this, a lot of the dialogue that used to take place in classified briefing sessions now to take place in a kind of code in public, in which the congressional interlocutors are trying to reveal as much as they can while not revealing any classified information? The example that I'm thinking of here is Ron Wyden in his famous correspondence with and public testimony with Jim Clapper, actually like revealed a whole lot, without actually revealing any classified information. And if the administration's not going to do oral briefings, aren't they relegating a whole lot of this to that format?
I suppose that is possible. We've seen a little bit of that from Senator Blumenthal when he was briefed along with other senators on these apparently very grave threats on in terms of election interference. He wrote an editorial, you know, sort of alluding to really bad things. I do think that members of Congress, many members of Congress, do feel some trepidation doing that because they could be accused of running up against revealing classified information. And even though it's almost certain that, you know, if someone went to the Senate floor and asked these questions, for example, they would be protected by the speech and debate clause, there's still the possibility of paying some kind of a price for that, whether that is a political price, if you're then that is then used to accuse you of revealing classified information, even if you haven't really done that. Or potentially there could be legal ramifications because adjudicating the speech and debate clause issues could take a very long time. And we know this president is not shy about potentially using the Justice Department in ways that are non-traditional, to put it mildly. So I think there's still risk there for members, and they're going to be careful with what they do and say in public. That said, the worse it becomes, the more the Trump administration tries to hide these things, I think the more members will resort to these other types of mechanisms for making the public aware of what is going on. And, you know, they're right to do that, I think, should be protected. I mean, when Lawfare published an article way back in 2013, actually before the 2014 elections, it was by Jack Goldsmith, but was kind of quoting an article written by Bruce Ackerman, where members should certainly have the right to tell the truth when administration officials have lost their credibility. This not only serves the cause of democracy, but it will deter further fabrications and distortions. You know, Americans should not cast their ballots amid a haze of doubt as to the basic facts. You know, that was a quote basically from Bruce Ackerman's article, and it applies so well now also. So we probably will see some of what you're describing, but it's better if members actually have all the information and can deal with it in a rational way. And that's what's being lost here.
And this really does get at how delicate the balance is between the executive and the legislative on this issue. Yes, perhaps this is just about a written briefing versus an oral briefing, and through some negotiation, they will come to an agreement. Okay, yes, we'll let briefers come back in, perhaps. But the signs don't look good for that, as Margaret said. And it really points to this delicate balance that's been around since the late 1970s, where after some unprecedented investigations into the heretofore relatively uninvestigated and unsupervised intelligence community, the society seemed to wrap around the idea that, yes, we do need an intelligence community that is more subject to oversight and, you know, knows that they have someone looking over their shoulder. And most analysts who have looked at this over the last 30 plus years have said, it's a net good. The intelligence community does better when it's informing the representatives of the people of not only its conclusions in intelligence assessments, but also informing them about covert action and other things that work better when they have buy-in from across the government. But it has been a delicate balance because the system that was worked out was for Congress to have oversight through these select committees. The intelligence community agreed to provide things to the Congress and answer their questions, and the executive branch, to greater and lesser extents across administrations, has said, yes, that is proper, that is right, we will do that. When there have been tensions, they have come out in interesting ways. Sometimes it's, we're going to run something in a shadowy part of the NSC that doesn't have to go and testify to Congress, or we're not going to answer your questions on this because it's too sensitive. And then Congress, if they want, when they draft the next appropriations bill, They can put in something about a report on that very topic that is required before an appropriation can be made, or in an authorization bill before an authorization can be provided. So those things have happened. But we have not yet dealt with that fundamental balance being pushed hard in one direction such that the executive branch could tell the legislative branch to screw off. No, we're not going to give you anything like this, and you can't stop us because it is a core executive function. That has not been the tacit understanding for decades. If this continues to go down that road, this could go downhill very badly because Congress could see its only alternative as defunding the intelligence agencies, which is not popular in general with the American public, especially when U.S. soldiers and sailors are overseas fighting in various conflicts. You could have the executive branch simply picking up its ball and going home and saying, we don't want to play this game anymore. We don't buy into that fundamental bargain that has been existing since the 1970s. To the extent that this conflict brings out a debate of what is the proper balance and how can we create institutions to bolster it, that's a good thing. But if that happens because the system falls apart, that's bad for all parties involved.
All right. I want to sketch out a means of in which this ends up being a much less big deal, which involves a variety of possible changes of constellations of power between the executive branch and the legislative branch. First of all, if Joe Biden wins in 2 months, Democrats are going to maintain their same position, which is that they're entitled to full briefings, and Republicans are going to join them. And there is no way that the executive branch will take this view against a united Congress. Hypothesis one. Hypothesis two, Donald Trump remains president, but the Senate switches hands, which is admittedly a less likely possibility. And there's no way the executive branch has the capacity to maintain this position if both houses of Congress object strongly. So this is a creature, Margaret, almost entirely of the executive's ability to do something when its party controls one house of Congress that will not survive the next time that is not true. What do you think of that?
I think your hypothetical number one could very well come to pass. I think it's entirely plausible. On your hypothetical number two, and if I understand you correctly, this is where Democrats control both the Senate and the House and are united. The question then becomes, what exactly are they going to do with the Trump administration? The perpetual problem that I have seen in this space with the Trump administration is that the Trump administration and President Trump in particular, they don't want a whole lot, right? Like President Trump prefers actings. So, you know, having people be confirmed isn't really a leverage point. Appropriations, obviously, you know, the Congress does the appropriations. We have seen President Trump take existing statutory provisions and use them to his advantage to move money around so he can, for example, build the border wall. The other piece is, and, you know, maybe you all can comment on this, I suspect President Trump would not mind so much if the, for example, intelligence community was not funded at the levels it's funded now, or maybe wasn't funded at all. I mean, President Trump is not a fan of the intelligence community. He's made that clear over and over and over. And so my point is, it's hard to know exactly where the leverage points would be with a second Trump administration in this respect. I think a second Trump administration will be emboldened. They will still have the information, and they can still hold it back from a Democratic-controlled Senate and House. And it would be some kind of an epic struggle. I don't even know what it would look like, again, because there's just, as I see it, not tons of leverage points with the Trump administration in the traditional way we think of the checks and balances between the executive and legislative branches.
I think the key variable here is what pushback there is, if any, from the Republican senators. And we saw Marco Rubio's letter, which was largely a screed against leakers. But he also did point out that none of what has happened involving leaking takes away the responsibility of the intelligence community to fully and forthrightly brief the intelligence community. We'll have to see if that goes beyond the statement and if he and other senators join with people across the aisle to say, you know, we need to do this in the right way. I think that that variable will say a lot for what happens no matter what the presidential election brings.
Bottom line, Margaret, do you think this is the thin edge of a wedge that, you know, more and more of is going to come in through the door? Or is this something that Congress is going to be able to rebuff?
I think at this particular moment, a lot depends on Mitch McConnell. If Mitch McConnell came out and made clear that this was not going to be acceptable, I think this could be kind of the end of this kind of thing, and the administration wouldn't be able to do much more, and maybe they wouldn't push it as much. I suspect he will not do that. So I suspect that the Trump administration may very well figure out what other areas of government they would like to do this, and push on those doors, see what kind of pushback they get. You know, if they don't get much pushback, I think they'll do more of it.
David, final thoughts?
Yeah, I'm putting myself in the shoes of intelligence officers and managers now. People not like DNI Ratcliffe, who is not a member of the community by training or perhaps by instinct, but the officers who have worked for years in their service. And to be frank, not every intelligence officer loves briefing Congress. Often members of Congress ask questions that don't get to the heart of the analytical issue, or they're looking at it through a prism that is not the way that intelligence officers do. So they don't always enjoy it. And yet, I think overall people accept the idea that intelligence oversight is a good thing, if for nothing else, for the reason you pointed out earlier on, which is you get buy-in from the people who authorize and fund your organization. And having that buy-in is useful when something goes wrong. And in the old days, you simply had to take the hit if it became public. Now you can go to Congress and say, but we told you and we warned you what could happen in this situation. So you're in this boat with us. I think there's something both reassuring for intelligence officers to know that there is that representative buy-in through the representatives of the American people from the public, but also something that allows them to take calculated risks, not wild risks, but calculated risks for the benefit of national security. Down the road, if that were to erode, I think that's a bad thing for national security overall. And I think most intelligence officers would see it that way. Right now, if Congress were to start throwing subpoenas around for intelligence briefings, that gets into a strange area that has not been fully explored before. But it really will also shine a light on whether John Ratcliffe listens to the intelligence professionals managing the agencies around him, including the CIA director and others, in terms of what is in the best long-term interest of the community versus what is in the best short-term political interest of Donald Trump.
We're going to leave it there. David Preece, Margaret Taylor, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the long-suffering Zachary Frank of the law firm of Goat and Rodeo. Our music is, as always, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. You can get Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com, and you know you want to, and you know you should. You should promote the Lawfare Podcast on YouTube, Facebook, TikTok. We still haven't had a TikTok video about the Lawfare Podcast, and we want one. And of course, you should leave us a rating and review wherever you found us. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.